Penguin Random House Audio presents Travelers to Unimaginable Lands, Stories of Dementia, the Caregiver, and the Human Brain by Dasha Kipper. Read for you by Holly Linneman. To my parents, Masha, Maria, and Alex Kipper. Preface. When I was 25 years old, I moved in with a man who was 98. I had not planned to, I wasn't sure I wanted to, and I didn't know if I could do any good. This man, whom I'll call Mr. Kessler, wasn't a friend or relative. He was a Holocaust survivor in the first stages of Alzheimer's disease, and I'd been hired to look after him. Although I had a background in clinical psychology, I was by no means a professional caregiver. I was hired because Mr. Kessler's son, Sam, thought his father shouldn't live alone. Not necessarily because he was unfit, but because he could use some help around the house. Like many victims of Alzheimer's, Mr. Kessler did not acknowledge his condition and went about life as though burdened by the normal aches and pains of aging, rather than by an irrevocable and debilitating disease. If he put the laundry detergent in the oven, or forgot which floor he lived on, he'd shake his head and sigh, "Mein Kopf arbeitet nicht." My head doesn't work. But it was a lament, not a diagnosis. And this denial, both clinical and profoundly human, led his son to misjudge the illness as well. Once ensconced in Mr. Kessler's two-bedroom apartment in the Bronx, I became, as so many caregivers do, a record keeper of someone else's obsessions. Where are my keys? Have you seen my wallet? What day is it? Where do you live? Where do your parents live? He didn't ask these questions every day in the year I cared for him. He asked them 9 or 10 times a day, every day. And since he always asked them for the first time, his sense of urgency never waned, and that urgency became my own. I wanted to help him, but I couldn't. I wanted him to appreciate my efforts, but he couldn't. A year before I moved in 2009, I was on an academic track to get a PhD in clinical psychology, studying pathology primarily through the dispassionate lens of quantitative analysis, with an emphasis on depression, PTSD, complicated grief, and anxiety. Although in some ways my studies were rewarding, I felt alienated by the generalities of research and the sterile, impersonal study of illness. I understood that empirical data and clinical trials were essential, but I also knew they did not offer a complete perspective on neurological illness, and I soon became disillusioned with dogmas and theoretical frameworks. What ultimately drew me away from academia is the same thing that initially drew me to it. Before I was a student of clinical psychology, I was a student of Dr. Oliver Sacks. I never met Dr. Sacks, but since I had first picked up The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat as a teenager, I had internalized his voice, his sensibility, his frame of reference. What made me fall for Dr. Sacks was how much he fell for his patients. As he narrated their stories, seamlessly integrating neurology with the study of identity, it became impossible to tease apart his clinical observations from his affection. Perhaps that's why I loved that he adopted the term romantic science from his friend and mentor, Alexander Luria, a Soviet neuropsychologist, to describe his work. Although the term romantic science is a nod to the 18th century tradition of incorporating personal details into the study of illness, it also felt fitting in the more vernacular sense. Dr. Sacks was so deeply moved and impressed by how his patients navigated their worlds and built meaning into their lives, both despite and because of their conditions, that his case studies seemed not just explorations of human consciousness, but also odes to individual human beings. So when I was asked to look after Mr. Kessler, I saw it as an opportunity to observe how a person fights to preserve his sense of self, even as a neurological disease was eroding it. Some mornings, Mr. Kessler knew who I was. Some mornings, he did not. Some days, he resented my presence, Some days he was glad to have my company. And some days, as if in gentle reproof to his own forgetfulness, he looked at me and murmured, "How long have I been like this?" Or, "Why don't I remember?" Or, "I don't know how you put up with me." Although this shuttling between confusion and self-awareness is often part of the disease, it is not typically reflected in clinical discourse. Instead, we have words like insight to address the knowledge patients supposedly have about their condition. But such words strike me as naively binary. Insight isn't a switch that turns on or off in someone with dementia. Indeed, no description of a patient's awareness can capture the complex, contradictory nature of a mind under duress, or, for that matter, of the mind that seeks to alleviate such duress. For his part, Oliver Sacks disliked the term deficit, which he considered neurology's favorite word. He disliked it because it tends to reduce the patient to a functional system that either works or doesn't work. As with insight, the term doesn't allow for ambiguity. And what is both poignant and unnerving about dementia disorders, which are presumably all about deficit, loss of memory, loss of attention, loss of inhibition, loss of judgment, is that before such loss occurs, there is often abundance. An abundance of yelling, arguing, defending, fabricating, and accusing. More to the point, there is often an abundance of the self. Where there is loss, there may be compensating behaviors, moments when the brain does not surrender to the disease, but arms itself with those faculties that are still intact, marshaling everything it can to compensate for what is slipping away. We refer to this kind of compensation as leaning on our cognitive reserve, which is both apt and ironic, given the upheaval and chaos this hidden resource creates for patient and caregiver. By using the networks that still function, the brain tries to preserve a person's sense of self, enabling patients to argue, charm, convince, fabricate, accuse, and persist. All of which makes the line between pathology and resilience increasingly murky. Indeed, we might say it's a patient's cognitive reserve, rather than dementia disorders, that initially accounts for the behavior that bedevils us. Throughout this book, I use mind and brain interchangeably, but I favor the brain when describing specific processes and the mind when speaking generally about human nature. My usage does not signal an endorsement of either side of the complex and heated mind-body debate. Unlike cancer or congestive heart failure, diseases of the brain present no demarcation between the illness and the patient. Patients collude with their malady and become, as Dr. Sacks put it, a long-married couple, a single compound being. In which case, who exactly is responsible for odd or contrary behavior? The man who charged into my bedroom in the middle of the night and asked me to find his passport was also the man who told me 2 minutes after I located it to get out because he had no need for me. The man who quietly spoke to me for hours about his childhood was also the man who told his son that he and I never interacted and that he'd prefer to live alone. The more I came to know Mr. Kessler, the more I saw him as a compound being whose contradictions were not merely a byproduct of cognitive decline, but manifestations of a man who wanted it both ways, to be completely independent and yet receive constant attention. And it was that man, in collusion with the disease, that kept me off balance. Ironically, the very quality I admired in Dr. Sacks's patients, the preservation of the self, was now making my job much more difficult. As Mr. Kessler teetered between knowing and not knowing me, between wanting my company and rejecting it, between happily eating the meals I prepared and accusing me of taking advantage of his hospitality, I felt myself pulled between feeling useful and feeling like an intruder. His oscillations began to tug at my own sense of existential rootlessness. Why was I here? What was I doing? Was I doing any good at all? It was my first indication that people with dementia disorders can still find your most vulnerable part and poke at it until you yourself feel unraveled. One evening, about 7 months.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?